So I have been going through some incidents in Jesus' life and death for the past several months. We've been touching and looking at things that happened the last week that Jesus spent in Jerusalem, and then some specific things that happened around his death and his resurrection. And today we're going to be looking at a very specific thing that happened, and that is when Jesus died, the curtain in the temple tore. We're going to be looking at the significance of that. So we find this in three of the Gospels, and I have two of them written on your sheet, and I'm going to go ahead and read those for you. So Matthew 27. When Jesus had cried out again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. At that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook, the rocks split, and the tombs broke open. The bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life. Now, that last part is a little kind of interesting, isn't it? But we're not going to talk about that. But it is kind of interesting. Wonder what the significance of that was. Okay, and then Luke 23. It was now about noon, and darkness came over the whole land until 3 p.m, for the sun stopped shining. Then the curtain of the temple was torn in two. Jesus called out with a loud voice, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." When he had said this, he breathed his last. So they just kind of throw that torn curtain in as if it's just a thing that doesn't really need discussed, that people who are going to read this are going to go, okay, the curtain at the temple tore, and they're going to accept that, and it's going to be absorbed into the new theology. And that's interesting to me, because in our culture we are so science-based that we want explanations for things. And so when we see something like this happening that seems to be supernatural, we want someone to discuss it more in depth, and we want either a scientific explanation or a supernatural explanation, but we want an explanation, and we don't get an explanation here. I think part of the reason for that is because people who lived before science was king or science was God, I think that there was a lot more acceptance of supernatural things like this. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about this as we go through. But just to get started, I think that people just accepted this idea, the curtain tore supernaturally, and they moved on. They didn't need an explanation for it. So what does this mean for us? So in our Christian tradition, we have kind of brought this in to our theology in this way. The curtain is a symbol of the old covenant. In fact, the law, living under the law. And that curtain in the law kept us away from God. We are sinful people. God cannot tolerate sin in his presence. Therefore, God cannot tolerate us. God must be kept separate from us. If you do an online search for the curtain and the curtain tearing, these are some of the things that you'll see. In Crosswalk, which is a fairly major Christian site, you read, "The curtain was meant to be a wall to separate sinful people from God's holy presence." In Bible Study Tools, which is also one of the major Bible study websites, "The curtain was meant to protect God from those deemed not worthy of his presence." So this is kind of the idea that we have brought with us, and it's not necessarily wrong, but we're going to try to look a little deeper. Jesus' sacrifice, our theology goes, opened the way to God. The curtain is no longer needed, so the curtain tears. So this torn curtain signifies the inauguration of the new covenant. We can now approach God. We can now approach the mercy seat without having a priest do it in our stead. Okay, this is right. This is all true and everything. We're going to flip the coin over. We're going to look at this instance from the perspective of not ourselves, but of God. So to do that, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to join the children of Israel in the desert at Mount Sinai. All right, so take yourselves back. There. We're not going to do the whole story. I'm going to touch on some of the highlights of the story and see where that takes us to. So when Jesus first brought the children of Israel out of Egypt, they did not know him. He had appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but it's been at least 400 years, and the generations that exist now don't know God. They've only heard of this God of Abraham through generations and generations of their ancestors. So God brings them out into the desert, and he wants them to know him. In fact, he wants to be known by them. When God talks to Moses, and he's convincing Moses that he is that same God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, he says this: God said to Moses, "I am the Lord. I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and to Jacob as El Shaddai, but my name is Yahweh." Okay, we say Yahweh in our American accent, Yahweh, but it should be pronounced closer to Yahweh. So it's more like a breathy sound. Doesn't matter. We don't even know for sure if that's how to pronounce it. He says, "I am the Lord. I will free you from being slaves to Egypt, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with mighty acts of judgment." He says to Moses, "I will give you the land as a possession. I am Yahweh. I am Yahweh who heals you. At twilight you will eat meat, and in the morning you will be filled with bread. Then you will know that I am Yahweh, your God." He's saying over and over to Moses, this is who I am. I am your God. You belong to me. I am Yahweh. I will give you land. I will heal you. I will give you bread and meat. I will take care of you. This is who I am. I want you to know me, he says. So then the people come out of Egypt. They cross the Red Sea, and God takes them to Mount Sinai. We're going to read now from your handout, Exodus 24:16-17. "Now the glory of the Lord rested on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it 6 days. And on the seventh day, God called to Moses out of the midst of the cloud. The sight of the glory of the Lord was like a consuming fire on the top of the mountain in the eyes of the children of Israel." So this is when the children of Israel first see God. They see him as a cloud on the mountaintop. They see him as a fire on the mountaintop. And throughout the giving of the law, if you read through Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy, when God is giving the law, he constantly puts this phrase in, "I am the Lord your God." He says, this is who I am. Don't tell lies. I am the Lord your God. This is who I am. Honor the widow and orphan. I am the Lord your God. This is who I am. Do justice. Be merciful. I am the Lord your God. This is who I am. He's constantly saying to them, this is me. I want you to know me. I want to be known by you. This is who I want you to be because this is who I am. So the instruction, what we call the law, what they call the Torah, is constantly filled with God wanting to be known by his people. This is who I am. Know me. This is who I am. So then Moses comes off the mountain, and we have the golden calf incident, which I'm sure you all remember. There's some angry words spoken. Moses goes back up the mountain. God says to Moses, "I will not go with you to the promised land. You go, you take these people to the promised land, but don't expect me to come along." And Moses is like, "Nope, I'm not moving from here unless you come with me." And God says, "But if I go with you, I might consume the people." And that word consume doesn't mean, I mean, it's not based in the word destroy. But it's interesting that it's consume. And if you think about God showing himself to people as a cloud and as a fire, you get a better idea of this, what this consuming means. God says, "I will not go with you because I might consume these stiff-necked people." But Moses refuses to leave, and so God agrees to go. This is an interesting picture of the Jewish idea of their relationship with God. Okay, so God agrees to go along, and then this happens on your handout, Exodus 33. "And then Moses said, 'Please show me your glory.' And God said, 'I will make all my goodness pass before you, and I will proclaim the name of the Lord before you. I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious. I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion.' But he said, you cannot see my face, for no man shall see me and live. And the Lord said, here is a place by me, and you shall stand on the rock. So it shall be while my glory passes by, that I will put you in the cleft of the rock and will cover you with my hand while I pass by. Then I will take away my hand and you shall see my back, but my face shall not be seen. And then that happens. God does that. Okay, so what is this glory that no man can look at and live, and that God showed Moses just the trace, just the backside of his glory? We see in what God says to him, part of this glory, a glimpse of the glory, is God's goodness, God's compassion, God's mercy. So these are the parts of his glory that we can see and that we can experience without having the effect of being crushed by it. It's seen, as I said, as a cloud and as a fire. Our English definition of glory is this: splendor, brightness, magnificence, majesty. So we kind of have an idea of what glory is, but it's kind of hard to put like into words. But we kind of know, and we kind of feel it. It's a word that we feel. In Hebrew, the root for glory is weight, weightiness, importance, or a heaviness. So God's glory is experienced as super important. When you discuss something important to you, you call it discussing weighty matters. So it's kind of like that idea. It's not frivolous. It's heavy. It's not something that you just take lightly, God's glory. We see a type of God's glory in our natural world. All those pictures that were being shown with the hymns, they're all like they were nature pictures, right? And the ocean and the waves and the sunset and the mountains, all of those evoke in us an unscientific feeling. The only way to describe it is just something deep inside of us responds to natural beauty. And C.S. Lewis had something to say about that. He said that we are looking at the skirts of God's glory, and that's why we respond the way we do. Whenever I turn out of solid rock and I'm driving down the highway and it's a clear day and there's snow on the mountains, there's a redoubt. It seems like every road in Soldotna leads to redoubt. Have you ever noticed that? And there it is silhouetted against the sky. And I've seen that at least 1,000 times. And every time I see it, something inside of me just twinges a little. Like I just know. I recognize that there's something about that sight. There's a glory in that sight. Who loves a good sunset? I mean, everybody does. You look at that and you're like, look at the beautiful sunset. And something happens inside of you. C.S. Lewis thinks that this is a universal response to beauty in nature. Science says, well, it's because it stimulates endorphins in our brain, and that's why we react to it the way we do. But why? Why does natural beauty stimulate that reaction? Science can't say. Science can't tell us. We don't know. It's like the last bastion that science can't explain. So C.S. Lewis calls this the inconsolable secret. There's something inside of us that reminds us that something is wrong with us. We are unable to be consoled in our present situation when we see natural beauty like that. In fact, we long to participate in the glory that we see. The great atheist, Carl Sagan, who was physicist or something. He's a famous quote. He says, we are made of star stuff. And when we have a reaction, especially when we're looking at the stars and noting how small we are and how big the universe is, he says that this is the stars pulling us back to our origin. And he takes that as proof that we evolved from something that is out there. C.S. Lewis says this reaction is a prophecy. It's not pulling us to the past, but it's pulling us to the future. It's a prophecy of where we are going. It's a glimpse of our future with God. So next time you're out in nature, next time you're looking at the Kenai River and that color of the Kenai River. Next time you're standing on Skelak Lookout and looking out over the lake and everything that's up there, and you feel that, just remember that that is a prophecy that's pulling you forward. You're looking forward to your future with God. It's kind of a little sidebar. Back to our mountain. So back to Mount Sinai. When Moses is on the mountain, God gives him specific instructions to build a tent, a special tent. This is called the Tent of Meeting. He's given specific measurements. He's given specific materials. He's given specific placements for various items that are supposed to be in this tent. And inside of this tent, there is a courtyard sectioned off. This is called the holy place. Ordinary people are not allowed into the holy place. The priests go into the holy place. And inside of the holy place, there is another curtain. This is a very thick curtain, and it sections off what we call the holiest of holies, or the superlatively holy, the most holy place. And this is where only one high priest every year is allowed to go. So this thick, elaborate curtain is not just one curtain like you picture, like on a stage or something. This curtain is a double thick, like almost like a wall. And if you read the dimensions of it and everything, it's very, very thick, like it's hugely thick. And it's a curtain where the priest has to lift up one corner and go in, and then he has to walk the length of the curtain and then lift up the other curtain, almost like a maze, and go in that way. So it's very specific. God gives very specific instructions as to how this curtain is supposed to work. And then he says in Exodus 29, and this is not on your handout, I don't know why, it just didn't get put there. And this is the purpose of the tabernacle, that tent of meeting. There I will meet with you and speak to you. There also I will meet with the Israelites, and the place will be consecrated by my glory. So I will consecrate the tent of meeting and the altar, and will consecrate Aaron and his sons to serve me as priests. Then I will dwell among the Israelites and be their God. They will know that I am the Lord, their God, who brought them out of Egypt so that I might dwell with them. I am Yahweh, their God. So God has a plan. He's going to travel with them, but he is going to dwell in this tabernacle, and he's going to be behind this curtain, and all that is so that God can be known by them. He wants to be known by them. Inside the holiest of holies, or the most holy place, is the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant is where Moses stores the stone tablets that God has given him with, you know, if you've ever seen the Ten Commandments, that old movie, which is actually very, very good. You know what the shape, right? You know what these stone tablets look like, and you know they have the Ten Commandments on them, 1, 2, 3, 4, in Roman numerals, right? Okay. So this is where the testimony, it's called the testimony. This is where the testimony is stored inside the Ark of the Covenant. And on top of the Ark of the Covenant, we talked about this, I think, 2 months ago. Do you remember 2 months ago? The atonement cover, the mercy seat, the atonement seat of Christ, we call it. And this is where God's presence, God's glory, comes down and dwells in the tabernacle on the atonement cover, on this mercy seat. And it is a thick, heavy, perceivable presence. We read in Exodus 40, on your handout, "Then the cloud covered the tabernacle of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Moses was not able to enter the tabernacle of meeting because the cloud rested above it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle." Moses couldn't go in. Moses could not physically coexist with the glory of God in this tabernacle. So God's presence now is in this tabernacle, this tent of meeting. And the Jews had a word for this presence. They called it Shekinah. You might have heard this word before. Shekinah, that word is not found in the Bible. It's found in later writings of the Jews. And it means indwelling. So the Shekinah, God's Shekinah glory, is the glory of God that dwells in the tabernacle. And it means the act of dwelling. It's not the place of dwelling, but it's the act of dwelling. So God's Shekinah, the act of dwelling in this tabernacle. And it is again, in these verses, it's seen as a suffocating cloud and a consuming fire. So this is God's glory, how they saw it. Later on, we see in 2 Chronicles, this is when Solomon has built the new temple, the original temple, I should say. He's built the original temple, it's new, the new original temple, and he is consecrating it to God. And we read, when Solomon had finished praying, fire came down from heaven and consumed the burnt offering and the sacrifices, and the glory of the Lord filled the temple. And the priests could not continue ministering in the house of the Lord because the glory of the Lord had filled the Lord's house. The priests had to flee. God's glory came down and the priests had to flee the temple because they could not coexist with the glory of God in the temple. So now back to the mountain again. This is how the children of Israel responded to God's presence when it came down. Moses, in Deuteronomy, Moses is just getting ready to go to the top of his mountain where he's going to die, and he's making a speech, and he reminds the children of Israel these things. So it was, when you heard the voice from the midst of darkness, while the mountain was burning with fire, that you came near to me, all the heads of your tribes and your elders, and you said, surely the Lord our God has shown us his glory and his greatness, and we have heard his voice from the midst of the fire. We have seen this day that God speaks with man, yet he still lives. Now, therefore, why should we die? For this great fire will consume us. If we hear the voice of the Lord our God any more, then we shall die. For who is there of all flesh who has heard the voice of the living God speaking from the midst of the fire as we have and lived? And then they say to Moses, you go near and hear all that the Lord our God may say. And then you tell us all that the Lord our God says to you, and we'll listen to you, and then we'll do it. Okay, so here is God, and he is longing to be known by his chosen people, the people of Israel. And they're scared because they're going to die. If they get too close to this burning fire, they're going to die. So Moses now is their go-between. All right? So God needs to protect the people that he loves from this consuming fire and from this suffocating cloud. And that's the point of this curtain. The Day of Atonement ritual, one day a year, the priests would offer a sacrifice, and then they would take the blood into the Holy of Holies, the most holy place, and they would offer this as an atonement for all the sins of Israel. Let's read Leviticus. I already got it here. And the Lord said to Moses, tell Aaron your brother not to come at just any time into the holy place inside the veil before the mercy seat, which is on the ark, lest he die. For I will appear in the cloud above the mercy seat. So God gives instructions for people to enter his presence. It's very elaborate. They have to be clean. They have to have special clothes on. They have to do it a special way so that for that brief moment when they're in the Holy of Holies with God's glory, with the Shekinah, they don't die. And God warns them, if you don't do it this way, my presence, my glory will consume you. So we see over and over again that this curtain is not God needing protection from us, but it's us needing protection from God. God is reaching out to us, but he knows who we are. And so he has the system set up where we are protected from being consumed by his glory. So there's a story that goes around, and you might have heard this, that when the priest enters the Holy of Holies, he goes in with a rope around his ankle in case he dies in there, and then the priests that are out in the holy place can pull him out without having to risk their own lives going into God's presence. Well, this probably is not true. It sounds like it might be like a great lesson in there for us somewhere, but it's probably not true. It's traced back to somewhere in the 13th century, and we just don't see the idea before then. It's in zero Jewish writings, and it actually would be against the orders that God gave, what the high priest was allowed to wear when he came into the holy place. So just in case that's in your mind and you're expecting me to draw some sort of, you know, some sort of life application from that. I'm not going to do it because probably not. Okay, now it is important for us to notice what is not in the Holy of Holies. We see that the tabernacle, I mean the Ark of the Covenant is there and the mercy seat is there. What is not there is also very interesting. So this tabernacle is a design that is seen across cultures from the time. In Egypt, it's found in Egypt and it's found in several other pagan cultures, the same design. So it's traditional. But God did that to emphasize to his people what is not there. So in these pagan temples, in their most holy place, there is a bedchamber for their God to go to bed. There is dining facilities for their God to eat. There's toilet facilities in these pagan temples. And God doesn't put any of that in there. And I believe that this is to emphasize to them, I don't need you to put me to bed. Because the pagan priests would put their gods to bed. They would feed their gods. They would put them on the toilet. That's what they did with their gods. This is a powerful statement to these people who don't know God yet. A powerful statement saying, I don't need you. You need me. And so moving forward, they're getting rid of the idea that this God of theirs needs them to take care of him. God has said, I am Yahweh, your God. I will take care of you. So flip the coin over. The original purpose of the curtain was not to protect God, not to keep him unsullied, not so that we don't dirty his robes. It's not the purpose of the curtain. The purpose was to protect us from the all-consuming glory of God. So, this is the way things were in Jesus' time. That curtain was hanging there. They were going through their ritual. Once a year, the high priest would make atonement for all the people of Israel. Happened every year for 1,000 years like that. Okay, but now something changed. And the first question we ask is, did this really happen? Or is this just a story that Matthew, Mark, and Luke threw into their gospels just to make a point? Okay, so we look back in some extra biblical writings and discover that, yes, indeed, something did happen like this. There are references to an incident where the gateway was opened, not necessarily a torn curtain, but a gateway was opened. It happened during dark hours. A lot of scholars interpret that as during the nighttime. But if you remember, from noon to 3, the land of Israel was darkened, for the sun was not shining. So it could very well have been during those dark hours. And it happened about 40 years, and this is extra biblical writings, 40 years before the destruction of the temple. So something unusual opened during dark hours at about the time Jesus was crucified. And we have historical record of that. So we're going to go with yes, indeed. Matthew, Mark, and Luke knew what they were talking about, and this actually did happen. Okay, so the timing, the time of day that this happened. Of course, we know that Jesus was crucified during Passover. This is not the yearly Day of Atonement, but every evening there was a sin sacrifice that was made. And this usually happened at what we would call 4:00 in the afternoon. So if this, according to the accounts in the Gospels, the land was darkened just before Jesus died, the curtain was torn. And so it's going to have happened sometime between 3 and 4 in the afternoon that the curtain was torn. Okay, so what's going on in the temple at this time is the priests, all of them, are there in the holy place looking at the curtain, and they're getting ready for the evening sacrifice. So things are, like, they have the lamb there ready to be slaughtered. They have all the incense all ready to go. They have everything ready to go. The high priest is all prepped and ready to go into the holy place. And just before they can slaughter the lamb and get the lamb's blood, just before that, Jesus dies, the curtain is torn, right? This is the timing of what is going on here. All they needed was the blood of the sacrificed lamb, and there goes the curtain. And all the priests are like, we're dead, because there's God's glory, and they know, you know, that you can't live in God's glory. But they didn't die. Something at that moment changed. And we're going to jump to Hebrews. The writer of Hebrews tells us in Hebrews 8, we have such a high priest who serves in the sanctuary, the true tabernacle set up by the Lord, not by a mere human being. They serve at a sanctuary that is a copy and a shadow of what is in heaven. So put that picture in your mind. What the priests are seeing when that curtain tears, this is happening in heaven. They're seeing it on land, but the writer of Hebrews says this is a copy of what's going on in heaven right now. This is why Moses was warned when he was about to build the tabernacle. See to it that you make everything according to the pattern shown you on the mountain. Because this temple, this pattern is important. And this is the important part of this tabernacle. God was setting this up so that the curtain would tear and the people would see that this curtain is tearing. So down here, the sacrifice of the lamb had to be made daily. The atonement ritual, the big one, happened once a year. It had to happen over and over again. It was a continually renewed covering because the glory of God would destroy people if they didn't have this continually renewed covering. This was to protect them, to protect us from being crushed by the weight of God's glory. Hebrews 9, it says, but when Christ came as high priest of the good things that are now already here, he went through the greater and more perfect tabernacle that is not made by human hands. That is to say, is not part of this creation. He did not enter by means of the blood of goats and calves, but he entered the most holy place once for all by his own blood, thus obtaining eternal redemption. For Christ did not enter a sanctuary made with human hands that was only a copy of the true one. He entered heaven itself, now to appear for us in God's presence. Nor did he enter heaven to offer himself again and again, the way the high priest enters the most holy place every year with blood that is not his own. Otherwise, Christ would have had to suffer many times since the creation of the world. But he has appeared once for all at the culmination of the ages to do away with sin, to do away with sin by the sacrifice of himself. So we don't need anymore that constantly renewed protection because Jesus' blood is a permanent solution. We are no longer crushed by the weight of God's glory. And again, this earthly picture is a picture of the heavenly reality. So this curtain in God's plan is no longer needed, hence the tearing. Okay, go to Hebrews 10. Therefore, brothers and sisters, since we have confidence to enter the most holy place by the blood of Jesus and by a new and living way opened for us through the curtain, that is his body, and since we have a great high priest over the house of God, let us draw near to God with a sincere heart and with the full assurance that faith brings. So from our perspective, we can now draw near to God. That barrier, our sin, has been removed. From God's perspective, he can now share his glory with us. He can now be known by us, which is what he wanted all along. Take a look at Jeremiah. And you knew that you couldn't get a handout without some colored words on it. So I'm not gonna dwell too much on the various coloring because you now know, of course, what all the colors mean and everything. So I'm just gonna read this. And this is a poem, and this is a very typical Hebrew construct of a poem. This is the covenant I will make with the people of Israel after that time, declares the Lord. I will put my story in their inward parts. In their hearts I shall write it. They shall know me, is what God's saying here. I will be known by them. I will be their God. They will be my people. They no longer will teach every man his neighbor or every man his brother, saying, know the Lord, for they will all know me. From the least of them to the greatest, declares the Lord. For I will forgive their wickedness, and their sins I will remember no more. So the torn curtain. The curtain, the before it tore, was a symbol of the old covenant, yes. The torn curtain is a symbol to us of the new covenant. God doesn't need protected from us. We don't need protected from God anymore. Because Jesus' ministry in the heavenly tabernacle, which this tabernacle is a picture of, Jesus' ministry in the heavenly tabernacle, because of that, we can now bear the weight of God's glory. We can enter, yes, God can now be known by us. Let's pray. Dear Father, thank you for giving us these pictures of your glory and what's happening in heaven. And when we look out on your creation and we see all the things that move us inside and make us say, there's got to be something that what we're reaching for, there's got to be something in that. Let us remember that this is your glory and that we're longing after your glory and we're longing to know you. We want you to be known by us. And we want to just thank you for being willing to be known by us. In your name, amen.